From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, one of the most compelling UFO cases ever, Shag Harbor. Here's what's happening. Well, you know how we care about you. 14 brands of bottled water have been recalled due to a potential E. coli contamination, including the store brands ShopRite, Stop and Shop, Giant, Acme, and Wegmans. Niagara Bottling has issued the voluntary recall for the water bottled from its Pennsylvania facilities. They've got a code that begins with an A or an F. E. coli bacteria shows the water may be polluted with human or animal waste, and it could cause all kinds of problems. The following brands bottled between June 10 and 18 are affected: Acadia, Acme, Big Y, Best Yet, 7-Eleven, Niagara, Nature's Place, Price Right, Super Chill, Morning Fresh, Shaw's, ShopRite, Western Beef Blue, and Wegmans. Just be careful if you have that bottled water. One of the biggest sunspots of the current solar cycle, it's called AR2371, facing right at us. And NOAA forecasters are saying there's a 70% chance now of an M-class flare, a 30% chance of an X-flare. You know, we've been talking about protecting the power grid. It's just going to happen eventually, isn't it? Hackers targeted air travel and successfully grounded around 1,400 passengers on Sunday. The problems for passengers started at a Polish airport after the airline says hackers breached its ground computers. The CEO of a Polish airline is warning all airliners that they are vulnerable. And, of course, the man who watches the Internet, Lauren Weinstein. Hey, there's got to be a movie there with that title, Lauren. Welcome back.
Yeah, that's not going to be a very uplifting movie, though. No pun intended.
Not at all. Anyways, what's going on with hackers these days?
Well, we just kind of keep descending into the pit of despair, don't we?
We do.
And it's not for lack of trying to deal with these things, but it's just more and more we see situations where hackers aren't terribly sophisticated, and it's just that in a lot of cases there's just some real stupidity going on with the people running these systems. We talked about the big OPM federal hacking situation, the Office of Personnel Management, and word is now that that may be something like four times more employees and past employees and maybe just people who submitted applications that were affected, maybe up to 18 million now, something
18,
like that.
Man. That's crazy.
And what's really, really crazy about this is, you know, how everybody's been saying they wanted smaller government and fewer government employees.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's what led to this situation because the pressures that that agency felt that they were under, you know, how they reacted, they didn't react very wisely, but they felt they were under these pressures. So what they did is they outsourced the operation of that critically important database comparatively inexpensively to international operations that would run them for them. And that brought in the Chinese. Because once you outsource something like this and you give people credentials to access those databases, you've lost, no matter what you've written into the contract, you can write anything in the contract, you only can have this kind of person, this kind of national, whatever. You don't have control anymore. And that's how they got in. They had essentially what we call root access to the database, which gives them everything. And you look at it after the fact and you say, well, how could this happen? This seems completely ludicrous. But in reality, it's almost guaranteed to happen the way we've structured the way we pay for these programs and what we demand for the amount of money we're willing to pay. You know, you try to do it on the cheap, and you're going to get shoddy results.
Absolutely. Lauren, thank you. And, you know, also I've always thought that maybe there's somebody on the inside that these hackers get to. The United States will contribute weapons, aircraft, and forces, including commandos, for NATO's rapid force to help Europe defend against security threats, including Russia from the east and violent extremists from the south. Under the plan, the United States will contribute intelligence and surveillance capabilities, special operation forces, logistics, transport aircraft, a range of weapons that support bombers, fighters, and ship-based missiles. They say they would not provide a large ground force. It always starts small, though, doesn't it? Throughout the prolonged showdown between Greece and its creditors, the Obama administration has largely sat on the sidelines, issuing the occasional warning about the potential economic impact of a default. But with Greece now on the verge of bankruptcy, the U.S. is also beginning to worry about the political fallout from a deeper crisis and the potential for Russia to gain increased influence over a NATO member. Russia wants to help Greece. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, Putin knows when to react, doesn't he, John?
Yeah, but I think Tsipras, who's a socialist, I mean, is just playing basically the EU and especially the ECB, the European Central Bank, against Russia. Putin is near bankruptcy himself. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, somebody who's really reeling from these economic sanctions, and they're in a recession in Russia. And, you know, the EU, uses, I mean, here's the bottom line about Greece, okay? They're never going to pay their debts.
No.
They're going to continue to replenish them, the ECB, because the Eurozone does not want to lose a member, because it would be, you know, a chink in the armor, a crack in the cosmic egg. It would potentially take down the entire Eurozone. So they're not going to let Greece fail. That's the bottom line. As far as the smoke about Putin, that's what it is. He's just trying to, you know, Tsipras trying to get a better deal so that they have less austerity. But here's the real bottom line about the way the EU and the Eurozone use Greece. Remember that the price of money, which is traded, you know, with the euro or whatever, they want a cheap euro policy. In order to maintain that cheap euro policy, they have to have the slackers, including these other countries, George, that are, you know, near bankruptcy, like Greece. So these continuous bailouts drives the currency down so they can perform better in the export markets. So when they complain about Greece, you hear Germany and, you know, Wolfgang Schauble, you know, talking about, you know, how the Greeks, we can't allow this, and Angela Merkel, you know, it's all smoke blowing for political reasons, when the reality is that if Greece were not in the euro, the euro potentially would, you know, climb to unprofitable, you know, levels for, you know, their export trade.
All right, John, thank you so much. And truth be known, we'll probably never pay our debts either. U.S. home resales surged to a 5.5-year high in May as first-time buyers piled into the market, the latest indication that housing and overall economic activity were gathering steam in the second quarter. Catherine Austin Fitz, of course, once worked for HUD. She was Assistant Secretary of Housing there. Do you think the housing market is indeed picking up, Catherine, or are they playing with numbers here?
I definitely think May was perkier than the earlier in the year, George. Part of it is home builders are not building as much. We're nowhere near back to building levels that we've seen before. And so you have more competition for existing homes. The other thing is one out of every three mortgages is underwater. The homes are underwater. So that creates a little bit more tightness in the existing home market as well. Big question is, will the millennial generation buy? They're really saddled with student debt. And my prediction is we're going to see student debt be a major issue in the presidential campaign, because everybody wants the housing markets to gear up, and that's not going to happen without the millennials coming in a big way. You know, the home ownership rate is still much lower than it was at the peak.
Catherine, I was about 22 years old when we bought our first house. I think it cost about $50,000. I think my payment was like $300 a month, and I thought, oh, my God, how am I going to make this payment?
Right, but I used to get up in the middle of the night to do cash flows. I was so worried.
But, you know, the one thing I thought about, though, at that age was, and it was a new house that we had built, one day they're going to stop building new houses because they're not going to have any room anymore for this.
Right.
I think that's starting to happen, isn't it?
Well, you know, here's the thing. We're encouraging the population to move into cities and mega cities. And so, you know, that's why it feels like there's no space. I assure you, some of us live in parts of the country, George, where there's plenty of space.
Lots.
You know, Where I live, you can buy a house for the price of what a chair costs, you know, on Park Avenue in New York.
I love it. Track what Catherine's doing. Go to her website, Solari, Solari.com. Saturn's moon Titan is home to seas and lakes filled with liquid hydrocarbons. But what forms the depressions on the surface? A new study using data from the joint NASA and the European Space Agency Cassini mission suggests that the moon's surface dissolves in a process that's similar to the creation of sinkholes on good old planet Earth. In a moment, we're going to be talking about your right to bear arms, the Second Amendment. And I want to qualify this for a moment. The tragedy in Charleston, South Carolina last week by some despicable person, a sick young individual. I want you to make sure that you understand no way are we affronting that situation with the following story we're going to have with the next couple hours. We're talking about the Second Amendment, your right of liberty. That story is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Larry Pratt has been the executive director of Gun Owners of America for more than 30 years. It's a national membership organization of 300,000 Americans dedicated to promoting their Second Amendment freedom to keep and bear arms. Their work includes providing legal assistance to those involved in lawsuits with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the Federal Firearms Law Enforcement Agency. And here he is on Coast to Coast. He's back. He was with me about 4 years ago. Larry, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to be back.
What timing after that tragedy in Charleston, South Carolina, which unfortunately brings out people who are anti-gun, and they create more issues. How difficult is it for organizations like yours to continue to tell people that Americans have a right to bear arms?
Well, George, in spite of the fact that they did leap on this, the anti-Second Amendment groups saw what they were hoping would be an opportunity. I honestly don't think it's going to work out that well for them. And one of the things that they're having, I think, trouble getting past the American people is that, wait a minute, that was a gun-free zone. The law of South Carolina left it in the hands of the pastor in that particular situation of a church and or his ruling group in the church, and if they decided that there weren't going to be any concealed carry firearms in that church, even though it's legal everywhere else in the state, not so in that church.
Oh,
well,
geez.
This was one of the leading anti-Second Amendment votes in the South Carolina State Senate. So he preached against guns and he voted against guns. And so it was pretty obvious to the dirtbag that that was going to be a gun-free zone. And we know from a guy that he'd been drinking with that he was looking for a place where there would be no guns.
That's right. He wanted to be in a place where nobody could defend, nobody could get at him, and he found the place.
Exactly. I guess we can be happy that they had a fairly sparse attendance, because otherwise he might have had a much greater body count, and that's apparently the only thing that might have limited him that night, because he was shooting fish in a barrel.
Larry, I want everybody to know that I've been, and they know listening to this program, but full disclosure, I've been a champion of the Second Amendment all my life. I'm a concealed carry holder. I've got a permit, and it's important that people understand that as we go through this interview. I'm not biased. I'm not tainting this. I may ask you questions as if I'm an anti-gun person. But I want everybody to understand that I've been a concealed weapons holder for a number of years now, since getting out of the Navy.
I doubt that you could be as hostile as some of the British questioners that we've been facing, even in the recent days after the shooting in South Carolina.
No,
the poor folks in England just don't get it. They think guns are the pits.
And, you know, you may get some rough phone calls later when we open up the phone lines, but everybody has a right to express their feelings as long as they
Absolutely.
Understand you have a right to express yours, too. Tell me a little bit about your organization.
Well, Governors of America has been lobbying the Congress for going on 40 years now, and we have taken the position that we're not interested in maintaining the status quo, but there are some things that have been put on the books at the federal level that really need to be taken off. One of them would be the background check, which failed miserably in South Carolina. The dirtbag had been arrested on felony drug charges 4 months before he shot up the church. If the government were efficient, but then now I'm making a joke, that information should have already been in the instant background database.
That's right.
It wasn't. And so when he bought his gun in February, 4 months before the shooting, nothing popped up. And he was able to buy the gun with money that his dad had given him for his birthday, the 21st birthday. So it was arguably avoidable, but it shows the pitfalls of relying on gun control when a more surefire way of having stopped that guy would have been having somebody else there at the scene of the crime who was a good guy with a gun. There were no good guys with guns.
Sadly, you're absolutely right. And around this country, we're faced with all kinds of episodes like this. Yet we've had some success stories too, Larry, as you know, where people who have had the right to carry in states, and they've been able to stop crimes, and they've been able to slow crimes down from getting any worse than they were. And those people are heroes.
And they once in a while make the news. There was a concealed carry permit holder out in Oregon who was in a mall. A guy started shooting up the place, killed one person not very far from where the good guy with the gun was. As soon as he saw that and heard that, he pulled out his gun, ran toward the shooter, and when the guy saw that a good guy with a gun was on the way, he committed suicide. And that's happened before, years before, in Colorado Springs. A church was attacked on a Sunday morning. The church is very large and takes controversial positions on a number of issues. So they were aware that they could be a target, and one morning they were. Well, they were prepared because they had set up defense teams, two of them at least. One would be worshiping while the other was out patrolling the premises, and then they'd switch off. And one Sunday morning, a guy who was very hostile to Christians decided he was going to take a few out of this world, came into that church, and before he could kill anybody, he was put down himself, ironically, by a woman who was part of the team that met him at the door. So, yes, guns in the hands of good guys generally work out well, and when there's nobody with a gun to protect people, it doesn't turn out so well.
Guns in the hands of people who end up shooting up malls or schools, generally, how have they gotten the guns? And then we're going to get into prescription drugs a little bit later on with you too, Larry. But how have those people gotten their guns? We saw what happened in South Carolina, of course. You know, he was given money by his father, and he went and he bought the gun. Generally,
typically, that's the way these folks get their guns. And most of them, unlike the guy in South Carolina, really had no record to show up on an instant background check. So the instant background check turns out to be quite a false security. And if we're relying on that to protect us, rather than having the potential victims themselves be able to protect themselves, we're going to have tragedy after tragedy, particularly in these gun-free zones. George, the only one of the mass murders in this country has occurred in what was not a legally imposed gun-free zone. All the rest were like the one in South Carolina.
That's true. That's true. Every day we are faced with looking at video from the Middle East with these fanatics called ISIS, and they're showing their guns and they're showing their assault weapons. And I want to know, Larry, How are they getting them? Because I'm convinced if they can get them, criminals in this country can get them too.
There's no question that criminals can and do get them in this country. There's an international criminal trade in firearms. They fetch a good price, the same
hold,
as...
Hold on, Larry. Where the clock got us faster than I even thought. We'll be back in a moment. I'll ask you that question again. Welcome back to Coast, Larry Pratt with us as we talk about guns and the Second Amendment. And of course, Larry's also an author on The Firing Line, one of his books, and Armed People Victorious. Larry, we're talking about how ISIS can obtain illegal guns and how criminals can get illegal guns as well. How do they do that? It's like, is there a network working within this country selling illegal guns to people?
There really is. Years ago, I had learned of an institution in Washington, D.C., when they had their virtually total gun ban, and within an hour, you could rent a gun, and that was the street name for the quote-unquote institution, but you could just ask around, hey, man, I need a piece. Where can I rent one? And you would rent it, and it would be a certain price if you brought it back unused, and if it smelled of gunpowder, that you'd fired it. Well, that reduced its value to the owner and increased its cost to you quite a bit. So the free market was quite at work. It didn't seem to matter at all that it was totally illegal what they were doing. And the only people that really suffered were the decent people of Washington who were being victimized by the folks that didn't mind breaking the law.
Across this country, the discussion of gun ownership, Larry, I think it's almost split down the middle, isn't it?
It's yes, but it is actually moving in the direction of folks owning guns. There have been some surveys recently indicating that there's a fairly healthy majority of people who think it's fine for somebody to have a gun for self-defense, maybe in the mid-60s. And the same, about the same percentage as I remember, people saying that they would be happy to live in a neighborhood known to have guns. I think people realize that, it's nice to be able to call 911, but even in an optimal situation, it could well be 5 minutes at least before the police are able to get there, and an awful lot of bad stuff can happen in 5 minutes.
Let me bring up a myth and get your reaction to this, that people with guns, if they get involved in road rage episodes, will use them. I haven't heard that. Have you?
Well, that's the answer. We haven't heard that. It's quite conceivable to me that somebody could dig up an example, but it is simply not the kind of plague that was predicted by opponents of such legislation. It just didn't happen. And you learn why. If you talk to people who carry firearms, you'll find out that the last thing in the world they want to do is to have to use that firearm. They will let you insult their mother. They will cross the street to walk on the other side. They will turn around and go the other way. They do not want to deal with the mess they're going to be in, even if they're in the right when they use that gun. It will at least ruin their whole day.
You are absolutely right. In most cases, people with concealed weapons don't want to pull it, don't want to use it, and will do whatever they have to avoid it. And as you said, walk the other way if they have to.
One of the things that we've known for some time, thanks to the survey research of Dr. Gary Kleck at the University of Florida, is that when a gun owner pulls his gun, well, one of two things. He may just say he has a gun to try to defuse the situation, or he may pull the gun, but in well over 90% of the cases, he never even fires the gun, and in a lot of those cases, he intentionally misses.
And the worst case for an individual with a concealed weapon is to pull it even if somebody's beating him up, is to pull it on a guy who's unarmed, no knife, no gun, then it even becomes even stickier, doesn't it?
Yeah, look at what happened to George Zimmerman. That was exactly what was happening. He was getting the tar beat out of him. It was good for him that there was a witness that saw his head getting pounded into the concrete, but it was kind of nip and tuck there for a while until people decided they were going to come forth and testify as to what they had seen.
Should most people who have concealed weapons, Larry, use it as a defense where you just hold somebody at bay until the police are called rather than try to fire it at them?
That's really a tough call. It's going to have to depend on the gun owner's assessment of the situation. Is the perpetrator evidently on drugs and not very rational? Is he enraged and not rational again? It may be better just to let the dirtbag flee rather than take further risk trying to hold the guy because you don't have, presumably, you don't have handcuffs. It's just you and him standing there, and if you are distracted for a moment, that could be very, very unfortunate. So I think the unless the cops are going to be there very quickly, you don't want a standoff. At least that would be my take.
Tell me about constitutional carry. What are we talking about here?
Well, it's a growing movement. The term refers to we have a constitution and we can carry a firearm by many interpretations of that constitution without a permit. We can carry it openly. We can carry it concealed. Handgun, well, long gun's pretty hard to conceal. And there are now six states that have enacted legislation that says just that. The first one was Vermont years ago. I mean, going on 100 now almost. Their Supreme Court threw out their concealed carry law, and since it wasn't broken, the situation that resulted, they never got around to, quote, fixing it. And so for all this years, liberal Vermont has been the longest running example of constitutional carry. If you want to carry a gun, do it. Their law is choice. It says it's illegal to carry openly or concealed a firearm for the purpose of criminally injuring another person.
Jeez.
So as long as you don't have that intent, you're quite legal. It's only illegal if you are thinking of robbing a bank or something of that sort. So we now see states finally starting to catch up to Vermont. And Maine, which is another liberal state, is the latest one to be added to the list of constitutional carry states. I think the governor has now signed that, but as soon as he does, if he hasn't already, it'd be very soon, then you'll be able to just put a gun in your pocket or your purse in Maine, and that's all you need to do.
That's all you need to do.
If you want to carry it concealed, no permission from any bureaucrat.
Researcher and author whom you know, John Lott, has written several books, and he basically has said with his work and research that there is no doubt that in states that enact concealed carry laws, crime, violent crime, goes down. And I assume you agree with that.
I do. I've read his work. I have to confess I don't understand all of his work because in some cases he was using some regression analysis, and I can pronounce the words, but I don't really know what they mean.
He's very methodical.
Of mathematically analyzing the relationship between various variables and the thing that you're studying. So does population density have any causal relationship to crime going up or down? And he was able to demonstrate that, no, it doesn't. Does income level have anything to do? No, it doesn't. There were only two factors of all that he could think of, and he asked other social scientists to suggest factors that they thought might have a bearing, a causal relationship to crime going up, violent crime going up or down. And the only two things that turned out to have that causal relationship was a cop in the vicinity and concealed carry laws on the books.
Let me ask you about police. Here's another area that we have supported on this program, Larry. I think, by and large, our police officers, men and women around this country, are doing an amazing job every day with some of these lowlifes that are running around the country causing problems, burglarizing people, hurting people. And our police are our, you know, first responders. They got to be the ones to get there. But lately, of course, a lot of them have been caught on videotape doing some really stupid things. What's your take on that?
Well, the body cam is probably going to end up being something that is in use in a lot of places, if not all. And probably on balance, it's going to work to protect police officers because I agree with you, there's not that many bad apples. And so when a good guy or a gal is in a situation where they have to use force, if that video cam was in fact on to show the context of what led up to the whatever altercation or gunfight or whatever it might have been, I think we're going to find that in the overwhelming majority of cases, that information will vindicate police officers. But by golly, if they are doing something unprovoked, if they're doing something unprofessional, it's going to expose them.
Yeah, it's going to expose them indeed. And you know what? There's going to be a lot of liability. There's going to be a lot of lawsuits. But I agree with you. I think the cameras will work both ways. And in a lot of cases, will probably protect police officers. It'll back up their stories.
Probably end up keeping situations from even happening because once it's common knowledge that the cops are wearing cameras, it's not just the cop that's going to be on camera. It's going to be
the perpetrator.
In the vicinity, maybe the perpetrator. So it seems to me, of course, I don't have any real proof of this, but it just seems logical to conclude that this is on balance going to help the police.
There's something called Operation Choke Point, which I believe is the initiative of the Justice Department, which they announced a couple of years ago. But tell me about that. What is that exactly?
Well, it's an example of the ingenuity of our president, who said he was, since the Congress wasn't legislating, as he thought they should, to restrict guns in the United States, that he was going to use his pen everywhere he could. Now, he didn't say he would have legal authority. He just said he was going to use it where he could. And Operation Choke Point is one of those examples of the president taking such action. He issued orders to the financial institutions run by or controlled by the federal government to stick at the gun stores and to charge them higher rates of interest on the money they were using and the credit card fees, that the processing fees that they were paying. And that was having quite an impact, frankly, to the point that one of the gun companies out in Arizona, McMillan, set up their own financial company to process credit cards for other gun stores, other gun companies, so that they wouldn't have this financial bite put on them by the Obama-inspired regulations that were hurting the industry. So I think the end of the story is that they're still trying to choke the gun stores off financially, but because of the success of McMillan, we just haven't heard that much about it. And I think it's a marvelous story of the ingenuity of the American entrepreneur, where government tries to get in the way, and it's like water. It'll just find its way around whatever obstacle you put in its path.
I'm pretty sure the St. Louis Post-Dispatch broke that story originally as well, didn't they?
They might have. It does go back a way. This is not something that the president just thought up. He's been at this for quite some time. And the name of it, Operation Choke Point, it's pretty graphic. It's, you know, I'm going to get my federal hands on your throat, and I'm going to throttle you. That's really what they're saying.
We're with Larry Pratt. He's the executive director of the Gun Owners of America. Let's talk a little bit, Larry, about the Second Amendment. There's an interpretation here, and some say, hey, it's just meant for militia. It's just meant to protect our country, not for every citizen. What do you say?
Well, it is meant for militia, but one has to understand what the founders meant by militia. They understood that each and every individual in those days, male, had to have a military rifle and be able to bring it with him if called up, if mustered for militia duty. And the Militia Act of 1791 is very explicit that that was the responsibility of all military age males. They had to have that military rifle. Today, the equivalent, of course, would be a machine gun rifle, an M16, the machine gun equivalent of the AR-15, which is probably the most popular semi-automatic rifle in the country. Now, the use of the Second Amendment has occurred maybe a couple of times in kind of dramatic fashion. And one is I think it's the overall movie is called American Story, but if you do a YouTube search for the Battle of Athens, as in Athens, Tennessee, just put in Battle of Athens, up pops the end of that movie, the last 15, 20 minutes. And it depicts the town of Athens, Tennessee, right after the Second World War, about 1946, I think, run by some really corrupt people. And veterans returning from the war got wind of all this corruption. They were kind of watching for what would happen in the Democrat primary, which was the only election that counted in Tennessee in those days. Mm-hmm. And the election was held, and sure enough, what they thought might happen occurred. The cops gathered up the voting boxes. This is an advantage of using paper ballots, because you can see the theft when it occurs.
Right.
Electrons are a little harder to watch. And they just gathered up the boxes in contravention of state law and took them over to the cop shop to, quote-unquote, count the ballots. Well, the folks had been kind of prepared for that, so not long after the theft of the ballot boxes, the quote-unquote militia, which was basically the men of the town and the surrounding area, came swooping into town in their automobiles and their pickup trucks, bristling with rifles, surrounded the cop shop. There was a brief gunfight, and it was evident to the cops that there were many more of the locals than there were of the cops, and so they surrendered, and they just left the ballot boxes, and wouldn't you know, the reform slate actually won the election. So there was probably the most robust use of the Second Amendment that I can point to, certainly within my lifetime, which kind of tells you my age. But then there was a recent example of this at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada, Bunkerville, Nevada, where this rancher, Cliven Bundy, didn't think he owed the federal government grazing fees, water use fees, mm-hmm. because he pointed to contracts that he had, and the Fed said, no, those are not valid. And they were in court, but the Feds couldn't wait, and they raided his place and sent BLM agents in.
That.
Well, as the nation saw, people kept coming initially from nearby and around Bunkerville, but by the time the thing was over, people were coming from all over the country with their firearms to defend Clive and Bundy.
Absolutely. It's an incredible story. Larry, stay with us. We're going to come.
Amazing.
We're going to come back with you in just a second. We're already at the top of the hour. We're going to continue chatting about your thoughts about the Second Amendment, and we're going to take phone calls. Look, you could be pro or against ownership of guns. We're not going to censor you. And if you want to share a story that might have occurred with you with guns, do that too. We'll be back.